Hey there, Rick Singeri of Vermont Edition. Just want you to know this podcast has been edited for brevity. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Phil Scott has been working the halls of the State House in Montpelier for 18 years now. First as a state senator from 2001 to 2011, then as lieutenant governor, and for the last 2 years as governor. He's up for re-election, and he's hoping to win your vote to have a second term in the state's top office. He faces challengers, including Democratic newcomer Christine Hultquist, who's garnering national attention. Scott has been getting national attention, too, namely for his evolving position on gun control. In February, he asked the legislature to send him several bills related to firearms. They did, and he signed them. Today on the show, we're going to spend the hour talking with Phil Scott about that and many other issues. We will talk with Christine Hultquist later this month. Phil Scott, welcome back. Nice to have you today.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
So let's dive right in and talk about some of the issues that you're facing and that you'll be dealing with. What's the number one issue that you think Vermonters should vote on and vote for you on? What's the thing that you think Phil Scott has that nobody else does?
Well, the challenge that we're facing as a state is really revolving around our demographics. And we've done some really good work over the last 2 years in trying to right ourselves in some respects and get our spending under control and making sure that we're not spending beyond our means. My foundation is built around my years of experience as a business owner, as well as some of the challenges I faced throughout my life. And I'm a fiscal conservative, and I'm not, I don't apologize for that because we're a state known for its frugality.
Do you think that there's pressure to be an apologist for being a fiscal conservative?
Well, sometimes when you're labeled as being a conservative of any sort in a very blue state, sometimes that connection is negative. We're frugal as Vermonters, I believe, and I think that runs across party lines. So I believe there are a number of Democrats who are conservative as well and appreciate that we're trying to do whatever we can to take care of those most vulnerable, but at the same time that we rein in our spending because we all have to live. And so we have, again, demographic challenges in the state. We need more youth. We need more people here. We need more families. We need more bodies. Our workforce has been depleted in many respects. And the only way we're going to accomplish that is by having an economy that's working and also addressing the affordability issues that we face as a state.
You mentioned demographics, and I know this isn't the demographic that you're talking about in particular, but you mentioned Democrats and that there are fiscally conservative Democrats, and certainly a Republican governor needs to win Democratic votes in order to be governor and to retain his seat as governor. So how do you try to appeal to Republican voters and appeal to voters who might otherwise be voting Democratic party line in running a reelection? I mean, that's a tough thing to weave, but also one that most Republican governors have had to do recent years.
Yeah. As far as trying to weave your way through it, I try and just be who I am. What you see is what you get. It always has been. I did that with the I've never served in the majority. And throughout my years in the state Senate, five terms, I was served in the minority. As lieutenant governor, I served in the minority. I was the only statewide office holder, Republican office holder. I'm still the only statewide Republican office holder in the state with the majority in the Senate and the House, not on the same team, so to speak. So I just try and do whatever I can, trying to talk about the issues that I think we face and try to be honest about the challenges and then what we can do about it. So I spend more time talking about my attributes, what I think we could do, my vision, and let the chips fall where they may.
Your opponent, Christine Hultquist, excuse me, she's the Democratic challenger nominee for governor. I spoke with her before the primaries in July, and she criticized what she called the tactics of your leadership. Let's listen.
You know, he's focused on the politics of division rather than solidarity and unity.
In what way?
Well, in certainly from what he's done to the legislature the past 2 years, I certainly wouldn't call it leadership. And I'll talk specifically about education, for example. You know, barking orders from Montpelier, coming up with arbitrary metrics and then beating up the teachers and school boards after they came in with a 1.5% increase and he had set the goal at 2.5%. I mean, that's pulling the rug out from under people.
And again, that was Christine Hallquist in July. How do you respond to that?
Well, again, I try and lead by an example. I've always treated people with respect and civility. I listen, trying to do whatever I can, trying to find common goals. It's the only way as a Republican. Again, I've been in the minority my entire political life, but I've accomplished a lot. And you don't get there by seeking division. I believe there's more that unites us than divides us. I believe that we have to get outside of the legislature at times, get to the people. Some of the things that I've been trying to do, for instance, our cabinet. And we have a very talented cabinet, very diverse in many different ways. But I thought it was important to get outside of Montpelier, to actually go to the other counties and listen to their challenges, their opportunities, and do what we can to help. And it's been extremely, extremely beneficial in terms of the response, as well as what we can do in giving the cabinet another perspective on what Vermonters are facing throughout our state. And it's very challenging.
But legislators told us they didn't feel like the lines of communication were open with you. They have told us they feel like it's very tense between the executive office and the legislature. And I understand what you're saying about going beyond Montpelier, but it almost sounds like what you're saying is I got to bypass the legislature.
Yeah, that's just not true. I mean, they're an equal branch of government. You have to deal with them. And it's something, again, that I've done throughout my entire political career. There's always a natural tension between the executive branch and the legislative branch. I don't care who's in power, who's in charge, who's the governor, who's the legislators. It's been that way ever since I can remember.
So you saw it when you were lieutenant governor when there was a Democrat in the governor's seat.
Oh, sure. I mean, they had their battles behind closed doors, but they were a supermajority. I mean, at the end of the day, they're not going to make themselves look bad. They're going to come out with something in unity. They had their disagreements behind closed doors, but they came out in the end together. Now, I remember when I was first elected, it was my first term. I was in the Senate, and Howard Dean was governor at that time. Now, I remember Howard Dean coming during a break, a recess of some sort, and coming to Bill Doyle, the dean of the Senate, and berating him in front of everyone, scolding him. In fact, there was a front page of the Free Press, the Times, Iris, I can't remember what, but he was wagging his finger at Bill Doyle and berating him in front of everyone else. I've never done anything like that. And it's just not my style. And
do you do it behind closed doors?
No, not at all. No, never, ever. And I would challenge anyone to say otherwise. I mean, it's very cordial. We may disagree, and that's okay. We can have our debates. But again, I believe at the end of the day, we accomplish a lot together because I can't do it alone. I need the legislature to work with me as well, and vice versa. So we accomplished a lot.
Can I ask you about that? You know, some of us have had parents who don't ever seem to take a stand and say, no, you can't do this, or I disagree with this. And it's hard to push against somebody who's not giving you either an affirmative or a negative and saying, this is where I stand and this is my position. And, you know, you respectfully listen, but if you're not having that argument, if you're not saying, listen, this is what I want, if what you're saying is, so how do you?
Oh, yeah, but again, from my standpoint, I was clear.
Yeah.
And what I said I could live with, what I couldn't. I said, we aren't going to raise taxes and fees.
Right.
Okay, that was pretty clear. I don't think anyone misunderstood that.
So you're clear in your positions.
I believe so. I'm trying to be polite. Trying to learn. Maybe there's another approach. I mean, I'm trying to do whatever I can to move forward. But I represent the people as well. I mean, they do in their own constituency, in their own senatorial districts, their House districts and so forth. But I represent all of them. So I need my perspective might be a little bit different than theirs.
Let's get to some of the calls. We have a lot of Vermonters who have questions for you. John is on the line with us from Newport. Hi, John. Go right ahead.
Well, Governor, I'd like to know why you want stricter gun laws here in Vermont where we don't need them. We had adequate gun laws. And a place like Chicago, which has the strictest gun laws, has more crime and more murders with illegal guns than any place else in the country. It seems strange that you would want to increase the gun laws here where we don't have that problem.
John, thanks for the call. Governor
Scott.
Yeah,
John, I appreciate the call. I would first advocate that you get the affidavit, and if you haven't received it, I'll provide one with you. I keep it with me wherever I go to provide it to people who need to understand the position that I felt we were in as a state. Public safety.
And this is the affidavit after Jack Sawyer's arrest.
Yeah, that's right. The Fairhaven affidavit. And if, as you recall, that was right after Parkland, Florida, where 17 lives were lost in Parkland, Florida. Fairhaven, through the good police work, as well as a young woman coming forward, tipped us off to the fact that this could be happening right under our noses here in Vermont. And from that affidavit, I determined that we weren't insulated. We weren't any different than anyone else. We were, we are the safest, one of the safest states in the country. And if that individual in Fairhaven had been able to forward his mission, we would have been gone from the safest to the unsafest. His goal was to have 32 kills, over 32 kills, to exceed Virginia Tech. And I believe that it wasn't a question of if, it was a question of which day. And after Parkland, that was escalating. I had to do what I thought was right for the state overall, regardless of the political ramifications. I went into that with my eyes wide open, understanding that this could cost me a future election. But I chose action over inaction, and I apologize for disappointing people, but I can't apologize for what I did because I thought it was the right thing to do.
Do you think? I guess more specifically, which of the laws that you signed, the bills that you signed into law, do you think will help in averting a school shooting in the future?
Well, certainly all of them in some way, but certainly the red flag issues and being able to determine if someone is in a state where they may misuse a weapon. That we would be able to confiscate that. I think that will be helpful in the future. It probably already has been, and as well, some of the every issue that was put forth, I think will help provide for some safety in the future. Now, admittedly, that's tough to measure because you're preventing something from happening. Prevention is always hard to prove. But if you prevent, you know, one life, 5 lives, 100 lives from being taken by this underlying violence, then we've accomplished something.
And you believe raising the legal age to purchase a firearm with some exceptions, limiting magazine capacity, eliminating bump stops, those will help.
Well, I do believe so. And I believe that you need a training. You know, we moved it from 18 to 21. I had a conversation with someone from when I was at Tunbridge Fair who was disappointed with me and couldn't understand why I had taken his 14-year-old son's weapon away. And I said, well, that's not the case. You've received some misinformation. He said, well, no, that's true. You said you couldn't have a weapon. And I said, it's just not the case. So there's a lot of misinformation.
Let's clarify, because you've raised the age from
18
to 21.
21.
Somebody can use a weapon that is the possession of somebody else when they're 14 to go hunting.
Just like today.
Right.
And if you're hunting today at 14, you have to have a firearm hunter safety course, like I did, as I did when I was 12. I had an NRA course then.
And under S-55, the bill that was signed, if you take a hunter safety course, you can still purchase a weapon at 18.
That's what I tried to try and educate him on, and I have a fact sheet on that as well. After the conversation, after we went through the whole conversation, because he said, you know, my father gave him that. And I said, that's still going to be the case. You still can do that regardless of this law. And I said, and if you, and if he has a, as he does today, if he has a hunter safety course, then he can buy a weapon at 18. So nothing has changed for your son at all. And so when we went through that, he said, you know, that's not what I understood. Thank you for the information. I wish you'd tell more people. And I, you know, I'm doing it one at a time. And it's difficult. But
The national narrative about this campaign, so far as there is one, often seems to say Phil Scott is vulnerable because of this change of position on guns, and he's not going to win because of it. Do you think that's a credible narrative?
Well, there's no doubt that I've lost support from some of my base over this. I understood that was going to be the case. I think I believe as well, as a Republican in a very blue state, you start a few points down right off the bat, regardless of what happens. So someone running as a Democrat, for instance, might start at 40 points. Someone running as a Republican probably starts around 25 points. So you already have a 15-point disadvantage to begin with. So,
but many
difficult.
Democrats had suggested that this should be a campaign about gun rights, not yours in particular, but that Democrats should become one issue voters and vote in people who support restrictions in firearms and in magazine capacity, such as you have. So, do you see this as a potential boost on the side of Democrats who might want to reward you for that position?
We'll know more in about 4 or 5 weeks.
You don't want me to ask you to be the pundit for your own campaign. We're talking with Phil Scott today. We're talking about the issues that are important to Vermont. And let's hear from Wendy before we leave the question of school safety. Wendy says, in regards to school safety, after the almost disaster in Fairhaven, would you consider putting more money into mentoring programs in Vermont in addition to putting more money into school security of buildings? According to the data, the more connections to adults youth have, the more likely school violence will decrease and also be reported should the need arise.
Well, as you might recall, and again, thank you for the question, but in the aftermath of the Fairhaven issue, on the first day when I said I had a press conference and I said that we needed I would be willing to consider any changes at this point in time. I was keeping an open mind, but also that we needed to move forward with a $5 million infrastructure improvement package for our schools. And I had tasked our state police and local law enforcement with doing an assessment of the needs throughout the state, and the legislature worked with me. There's another example of the legislature working with me on this issue, across party lines, to try and move forward on something that I thought was so important. So we passed this package. We're able to. We've implemented those. We've issued the grants. Did the assessments. So we're doing that. And I believe that there are more that we're going to have to more improvements that can be made, should be made. But certainly, this amount of the millions of dollars we spent thus far will be beneficial as well. Mentoring is important. Role models, better role models. I talk about this a lot. You know, especially in this day and age, we need more and better role models, and each of us has an obligation to do so.
Does that come along with funding, though? I mean, each of us has an obligation.
Well, it doesn't have to be funding. You know, I think we can just take responsibility. I mean, we think about this. I was at, it was interesting, I was at our capital for a day in Chittenden County, and I toured the Winooski School. And I was so impressed, first of all, by the amount of diversity in that school. They were so well behaved. It was so well run. But one of the interesting, I thought it was brilliant, they had their lunch program in their gymnasium. So they bring the tables out during lunch periods. And they put the 11th and 12th graders together with the first and second graders, and they have lunch. And I believe that brings out those role models, I believe, and it seems to be the case from what the officials told me. So, again, we can learn from that. We're all role models in our lives in some ways. We just don't realize it. So it's important for us to act appropriately.
Let's go to John, who's calling in from Putney. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Hi, Jane, and hi, Governor. Governor, despite your promise to for the most vulnerable Vermonters.
John, did we lose you? I think we may have lost John. So let's talk about something else then, and we'll see if we can get John back on. I want to talk about something that just happened today because I think it will help illuminate something in Vermont. And so today, Jeff Bezos at Amazon said that his company is going to increase the minimum wage of all of its workers, including workers at Whole Foods, including seasonal and part-time workers, about 350,000 workers altogether, increase the minimum wage for them to $15 an hour. And he said he will be encouraging Congress to make some changes to the federal minimum wage policy. You vetoed a minimum wage bill in Vermont this past year. Is it something that you think should be done at a federal level? Are you open again to an increase in minimum wage? Do these big national companies, including Amazon, making changes, put any pressure on you?
Sure. A couple of ways to look at this. First of all, it didn't take an act of Congress for Amazon to come forward and make those changes. I think as a business owner myself, we in the construction industry in particular, I can't think of too many people making less than $15 an hour. So you make those choices when you're competing for the workforce, especially here in Vermont, where we have such a shortage of workers. So there's an increase in wages that's happening naturally. The supply and demand is mandating that. In fact, I was out. Somebody told me out in the valley at a creamy stand. They were advertising for help, and they were listing that at $17 an hour. So there are opportunities out there in very severely impacted areas where the wages have come up. In terms of it happening, if it's going to happen, it should be at the national level. That's where it should happen. Because what happens with us is, especially with us competing with New Hampshire, and New Hampshire's minimum wage right now follows the federal minimum wage. I think it's around $7.25 or $7.50. So when we're on the eastern side of the state along the Connecticut River, those businesses are impacted by whatever decision we make in the state. And those in New Hampshire are at an advantage from many perspectives. No sales tax, no income tax, lower minimum wage. So it's difficult for those in the rural parts of our state, particularly along the eastern side of our state, for them to compete. And that's what I was concerned about, that if we do this alone, we already have challenges in terms of affordability. This is going to make it worse. So
why not get rid of the sales tax? Why not get rid of income tax and be more like New Hampshire and compete across the state that way?
There are many people who think we should do that. But you know, I can buy into some of that, but you can't do it overnight. Obviously, what we're trying to do, what I'm trying to do, is to live within our means, not grow our budgets any faster than our revenue streams, faster than the ability of people to pay, so that they can keep more money in their pockets. And I think that's, you know, if you really drill down, I believe each and every one of us wants that for Vermonters. We have different approaches on how to accomplish that. Artificially raising the minimum wage just in Vermont may accomplish some of that, but it furthers, it makes Vermont more affordable in a lot of different aspects. As well, from my standpoint, with our tax policies and our tax burdens, we are taking some of that money away from them. We did that. So we need a balance.
I think we have John back in Putney, so we'll try this again. Hi, John. You're on the air. You there?
Hi, I'm still there. I hope you can hear me. Thanks, Governor. You campaigned saying that you'd help and stand behind vulnerable Vermonters, but you've made six or eight vetoes, not just of the minimum wage bill that was passed by the legislature, but the paid family leave program, which for someone making just $25,000 a year would cost them only $34 in taxes a year. And you also vetoed a bill to protect children, Vermont's children, from toxic substances in the drinking water and in children's products. And I just don't understand why you're in fact, harming vulnerable Vermonters and seem to be going along with what the manufacturers and the corporate interests are asking for.
John, thanks for the call. And when John talks about what it would cost, the paid family leave bill, this was going to be funded through a payroll tax.
Sure.
Governor?
Well, a few things. First of all, I would advocate, and I'm sure John has done this, to read my veto message on each and every one of those bills. And it clearly states what some of the issues were within those bills, and they may not be as evident as you might expect. We'll take paid family leave, for instance. I believe that we could have a voluntary paid family leave here in Vermont. New Hampshire was talking about it. I was speaking to the governor there about the moving forward with that. Maybe there's an approach where we could work together to make it have it done on a volunteer basis and have a bigger pool of dollars and resources by combining the two states. I still believe that that could be a path forward. The problem that I had with that were many. One, I don't believe that we should be raising taxes and fees at this point in time. Our economy is growing. We're having more revenues coming into the state. I think that's the answer. By placing more of a burden on employees and employers, I think is the wrong approach. I believe as well that that was underfunded, that it wasn't going to be enough. And I believe that the Joint Fiscal Office actually said the same thing, that it wasn't going to be enough to take care of the need. So what would look like a small amount of money as a payroll tax in 1 year would have to be raised significantly to accomplish what the goals were. So I just want to be go into this with our eyes wide open, and I believe that there's a voluntary approach that we could take, and let people decide for themselves.
So what though is your plan or your approach for tackling the affordability crisis, particularly for Vermonters who are facing poverty? And there are a lot of different issues that go into that, of course, but what's the approach?
Well, again, I think we need organic growth here. We need more people in the state. Our demographics are part of our challenge. The average age of a construction worker, for instance, is 58 years old. When you think about that and what that represents, when you're going to need an electrician or a plumber or a carpenter or an auto technician 10 years from now, it's going to be an issue. When you look at the census over the last 10 years, we've lost 30,000 people out of the age group 25 to 45. That is our workforce. Those are the folks that pay, have families, buy homes, utilize services, buy products, and pay taxes. So if there are fewer people paying taxes, it puts the burden on the rest of us. So organic growth will alleviate a lot of the pressures we're feeling, but we're going to have to make investments in areas that give us that return. And we can't make the problem any worse in the meantime.
Well, here's one of the areas that one Vermonter would like to see you address. Laura in Burlington says child care has become a huge issue for many Vermonters, especially young adults who you have identified as being important for growing Vermont's economy. What's your plan to address the lack of affordable quality child care, which includes increasing wages to encourage people to work in the early childhood field?
Yeah, I agree. There's an area that we need to work together on. I'm advocating for a cradle-to-career type of education approach. We currently spend $1.7 billion for our K-12 education system. It's one of the highest in the nation, about over $22,000 per student, whereas a state like Florida pays around $7,000. So we're from my standpoint, and we've lost 30,000 students over the last 20 years. We have 30,000 fewer students than we did 20 years ago. So that's part of the problem. But we have a need, I believe, in early care and learning. We should be investing. The science is real. You know, a child's brain develops immensely fast, 0 to 5. So we need to make more investments there that will give us a good return later in life. So if we take the $1.7 billion and take that and reinvest some of that in early care and learning and some of it in higher education, because right now we spend about 5% for early care and learning, 5% for higher education, and about 90% for K-12. I'm just saying we're spending enough money. We need to invest it in different ways, and we have to have the courage to think outside the box in order to do that. So that would provide for much of what our issues are and become.
But how? Because when you talk about early education, the universal pre-K law in Vermont starts for children aged 3 and provides for 10 hours a week of preschool education. For working parents who are working 40 right. or more hours a week and who have a 12-week-old, you know, that doesn't cover that. So what's the
But that's what
is
I'm
there?
Saying.
Yeah, what would the plan
saying,
be?
I'm saying invest more.
How? You know, but how would you do
because
it?
You can because our system, our K-12 system, is inefficient.
No, I get that. So you're taking it from the K-12 to sort of reassign it. But
sure.
In what way? How are you going to get that
maybe
money
to
the parents?
There's all kinds of ways of doing it. Maybe you'll go to 20 hours. Maybe you'll go to some other. You just make the investments in the areas that there are experts right now working on this. Mm. They know where the need is and where we could spend the money. But we have to think creatively. We have an opportunity to build. We have a good education system in Vermont. We have great teachers, good education system, but it could be the best. And we're so nimble and small that we could do this, and it'd be the best economic tool that we could possibly buy. I mean, it's right there in front of us.
So would that be part of your inaugural address, a new vision for Vermont?
I talked about it in my initial.
Yeah.
I talked about this.
Yeah.
So, but we can't continue to do what we're doing today because it's not working. We need to do better.
Let's go to Mark. Mark, who's calling in from Ludlow. Hi, Mark. Go right ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. This isn't specific to you or the Republicans or Democrats. It is specific to Montpelier and the legislature. If you remember that accident on 89 where a veteran had the accident, got out, stole a police car, turned around on the interstate, came back and hit the accident again, killing the high school kids. That was a case where high school kids were killed. Fairhaven was a case where they were almost killed. The common denominator is mental health. It don't matter if it's gun control, car accidents, suicide, domestic violence, drug use. Everybody knows all its problems have mental health problems. And since Waterbury got washed out in Irene, Montpelier, if you follow the legislator, they can have some of the goofiest things they spend their time on and it don't matter. Both sides continually say, yeah, we know about mental health. Yeah, we're working on it. But in years and years, we're getting nowhere.
So, Mark, let me put a fine point on that and put that to Phil Scott. What about? What would you do to address mental health?
Well, first of all, in terms of the gun legislation as well, I appointed a gun violence or a violence oversight committee to look at the root cause of the problem. People from all walks of life, gun owners and mental health providers and law enforcement alike, and to try and look at the underlying issues, because we do agree that it's not the guns, it's the person behind them. So, and the mental health is a huge challenge for us. In connection with the opioid crisis, it lends itself to many different outcomes that are affecting our state. We know through our hospital providers, our system, that there are many challenges with mental health, and some of the emergency rooms are being overwhelmed in that respect. We're working with the UVM Medical Center at this point in time. They're moving forward with a proposal here in Central Vermont for a bigger facility. After Irene, there was a 50-bed facility in Waterbury. It's now a facility in Berlin, and I believe it's 25 beds. It might be smaller, but that was because of federal guidelines. But this facility that would be built at Central Vermont Medical Center will be much bigger, and will provide a relief in that regard. We've also taken some measures in terms of embedding some mental health counselors in the community to try and head off any issues that might be brewing in some respects. That's been being done in Chittenden County right now and is having a positive effect, I believe. Again, hard to measure prevention, but I believe it's making a difference. We need to do more of the above. We've done more in terms of making it more palatable for mental health counselors to get training. So we need, I agree, we have an underlying issue of mental health that's growing. It's growing in our schools. It's hampering many within our schools. And we need to do better. But we're moving forward with that. We're not ignoring that at all.
Let's go to Mac in Callis. Hi, Mac.
Taking my call. I just had a question for Governor Scott. You know, his Secretary of Education and Agency of Education is recommending consolidating our local school district and my town of Callis and the neighboring town of Worcester with lower average incomes and no appreciable school debt. We'll have to assume the school debt of the higher income towns in our district. This will dramatically increase our taxes over the life of these other towns' debt. And I just wonder how, you know, and we never voted on any of these bonds. How can Governor Scott explain his imposition of this grossly unfair state mandate on our school district?
Well, again, this wasn't my initiative. As you might recall, Act 46 was proposed and passed by the Democratic legislature before I became governor. I was lieutenant governor at the time. While it's not perfect, it's not something that I would have moved forward with, may have made some changes. It was a step in the right direction to achieve what we know is a growing issue in the state. And I talked about this earlier, 30,000 fewer kids than 20 years ago. That's a problem. And that continues. We lose three children every single day. There's a reduction in the number of students in our K through 12 system. So in Act 46 as well, as imperfect as it might be, is something that's the law and we need to follow through on. I have an obligation to follow the law. So it's not about it's a governance consolidation. And it's not about closing schools, though I realize in some towns one may lead to another. And I understand this is really contentious, and no one wants their schools to close. I remember Shap Smith talking about this, and he said, everyone thinks it's a great idea to reduce spending and do something about the inefficiencies in the schools, unless it's their own.
Former Speaker of the House,
Shap Smith. That's right, Shap Smith. And so I understand that. We talk with them every single day. But look at Rochester, for instance. Rochester closed their high school. They had two students in their high school, two. And tell me, you know, convince me that they're getting the quality of education that they deserve. I can't imagine that they have the drama, the interaction with other kids. And when I'm talking about drama, I'm talking about theater.
Not high school drama.
No, we have enough of that, regardless of 2 or 200. But we need to look at the opportunities for kids in certain parts of our state.
But so, Rochester may make that decision and say, this isn't working.
They did make that decision.
Yes, but other communities are saying, we would make a different decision. We do believe our school is working well. We do like the governance structure we have. We don't want to merge districts, and you're telling us we have to.
But Act 60 changed everything. Act 60 pools all the money together. So those who are doing a great job and saving all kinds of money and doing whatever they can to provide the high-quality education without burdening the system are paying for those higher-spending districts, and that's not fair either. So I think with a changing consolidation of the governance structure, at least we'll see some opportunities to work together. Maybe there's areas where you can have a language teacher go between schools. Maybe you could have a school nurse that doesn't have to be there all the time, can go to between different schools. There are opportunities to do things more efficiently when we hear and understand that. I mean, I see it every day within state government. I'm trying to break down the silos, trying to make sure that we're, as secretaries, commissioners, and deputy secretaries and commissioners, deputy commissioners as well, talking with one another about opportunities within within our entire state government to look for opportunities to do things together. And I think that that's what we need to do with schools as well.
So we just have a couple minutes left, and I know this is not fair because each of these issues could be well worth, you know, they've been worth shows, let alone, you know, 30-second answers. But just to touch on a couple of other topics, one point that several callers and listeners want to ask you about is telecommunications, broadband internet build-out. This is something, boy, every single governor has talked about, every single gubernatorial candidate. Oh, we're going to make it so that you can telecommute, you have high-speed internet, you have cell phone service. What are you going to do about
that? Yeah, well, we're going to continue to make sure that we prioritize in the growth centers and growth areas that we have. You know, what's interesting is when you look at the top 10 highest speed access that we have in the state, the list, you'd be surprised. Burlington is on the list. That's no surprise. But Newport's on the list. Springfield's on the list. Brattleboro's on the list. So it's not the complete answer, but it's part of the solution. And 260 out of the 300 schools that we have high-speed broadband access. So we need to make sure that's 300 out of 300. But we'll continue to work in that regard. Velco has fiber optic throughout their infrastructure. I believe there's an opportunity for us to work together with Velco to provide for that infrastructure, to branch out and then, again, focus in those areas, those growth centers that we need. They need the help.
On marijuana policy, you signed into law the bill that legalized small amounts of recreational marijuana, allows people to grow at home. You want a roadside sobriety test before you would look to a tax and regulate system. Is that a hard and fast no-go
yeah,
for you?
Yeah, we need more roadside testing. We also need more education. We have an opportunity to listen to other states and listen to what they've done. And they have advice to us about what they would do before going to a tax and regulate system. And part of that is, you know, roadside testing, you know, education, prevention. And why not do that first and prepare ourselves for the next? We don't need to make a mistake on this. The stakes are too high. And I believe that we have an opportunity to do so.
Water quality funding. I said I hear you have a plan, but not revealing the details yet.
Well, yeah, I mean, we have a plan that we've been working on. We're spending more money in the last 2 years and a 70% increase over previous years. So I'm committed to water quality and water quality funding. I'm just not interested in providing another tax because we already use some of the property tax transfer, as well as we clawed back some money on the deposits. And there's but we'll fulfill that gap. TDI is still an opportunity for us to receive more funding if Massachusetts decides to go with us, which I think they will eventually. So we have other opportunities, and I'll unveil what I'm thinking in the budget address if I'm so fortunate to be elected.
That is Governor Phil Scott. Thanks for talking with us
today. Thank you very much for having me.
Phil Scott is a Republican. He'd like your vote for a second term as governor. And we'll be talking with Christine Hallquist, running as a Democrat, on Monday, October 15th. You can find all of our campaign 2018 coverage at vpr.net.